Welcome to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, we speak with Howard Chaykin. As evidence in recent runs like his revamp of the Challengers of the Unknown, DC's Hawkman, and New Avengers 21, no one designs a page of dynamic, sequential action like Howard Chaykin. His signature style of writing hero fiction stands out with his creator-owned landmark series American Flag, the controversial X-rated Black Kiss, and his popular revamps of The Shadow and the Blackhawks. For over a decade, Chaykin brought his writing sensibilities to Hollywood to write for television series like The Flash and Viper, plus he was the show-running producer for the popular syndicated show Mutant X. We'll cover past and present Chaykin projects, including his upcoming runs on Blade with Mark Guggenheim for Marvel, and at DC and arc of JLA Classified, and a Guy Gardner Green Lantern miniseries. But first, we start with a look at Bite Club, the Miami crime family of vampires, co-written with David Tishman for Vertigo Comics. Let's start with Bite Club. I enjoyed the first series and I'm enjoying the sequel.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very kind.
How did you first hook up with David Tishman? I know you guys did American Century together as well.
I met Tishman when he was doing development for a guy in Hollywood, and we had mutual interests, and we became friends and then partners, and that's it.
You just found that you guys have a similar style as far as storytelling?
No, we had similar interests. We had similar sensibilities. We didn't share wives, but, you know, David is... He's a complex figure. I'm being elliptical because I really don't feel like talking about Tishman.
I'm curious, and obviously you have to expect comparisons to from Bite Club to things like Black Kiss. They're vampires, and certainly different locations and different stories. But
and different artists.
Certainly different artists.
And different times.
Definitely different times. Well, let me ask you about David Hunt specifically.
A talent.
Absolutely.
One of these guys who should be a world-class figure, an absolutely astonishing talent. I love David Hunt's stuff. He's one of my heroes.
Being as visual as you are, how much of your... Do you do breakdowns for David? Do you do anything?
None.
Do you do it for anybody that you work with when you're just scripting and someone is being the artist? Or is it
Last time I did that was on American Century.
Now, I'm glad you said that because I always felt there was kind of a visual sense of your design, even though... And who was the artist for American Century?
Mark Laming was the guy he did the thumbnails for. I felt that Mark had a kind of a polished, illustrative effect, but he didn't know how to tell a story visually as well as I'd like. And Shelley Bond had me get in there and do do thumbnail breakdowns, which were pretty schematic. You know, they were... You know, I mean, I'm not putting myself in the same class, but they were technically, in terms of, you know, black marker on white paper, about as evolved and detailed as stuff that Kurtzman did when he was doing Two-Fisted Tales in Frontline Combat.
Wow. Has Vertigo come in and told you, you know, you can go as far as you want to go?
No. They've censored me considerably.
Okay.
Well,
I figure the guy with when he shows up with testicles in his mouth, I think you're okay and you're getting carte blanche, but obviously not.
No. I mean, they draw the line for me on a regular basis.
Okay.
No kidding.
I believe it.
And I really do try to get... I mean... I'm not actively pushing the envelope. I just do stuff that amuses me, and then all of a sudden people get like, "Oh, that's horrible." don't do that again, please.
You have a lot of black humor in your work, and it's I guess it depends on the audience. I always found you funny.
I still think the Black Kiss is one of the funniest things I've ever done, but there are people who look at me like I'm fucking crazy. I find humor in the worst places. I'm a great believer in what Picasso said, which is good taste is the enemy of art.
And it sounds like I've heard you say before that your work represents, it's usually sex, violence, and just a good blend of humor.
And I also think it confuses the people who don't like that sort of stuff dramatically when you get that sort of content combined with a guy who's obviously articulate enough to defend himself under any criticism, which must piss the fuck out of these people enormously. You know, in the comic book universe, people who have attitudes and sensibilities like I do actually should be more like Jasper Sidwell or Alfred the Butler. You know, and I'm not. You know, I'm that well read. I'm that much of a fuss budget, but I'm also a dirty minded, you know, guy, and happily so. Go figure.
Thank God.
I'm with you, Fallon.
Let's talk a minute about Black Kiss, because have I heard correctly, a prequel is in the works?
You know, you took the words right out of my mouth. Yes, we are in the process of getting that set up.
Fantastic. It's interesting because with Alan Moore's Lost Girls...
I can't wait.
Well, you know, yeah, me
either.
I know,
I heard.
And yeah, like, you know, the environment today. And, you know, you had your share of... It wasn't censorship because it got out, but certainly it had to be in the Mylar bag and... You know,
actually, the funniest part is actually there was a censorship issue, which was hysterical. first issue of Black Kiss was previewed and published in its entirety in Penthouse Variations.
Okay.
And it had to be censored for that publication.
Wow. Guccione is censoring
it. Oh, no, it wasn't Guccione.
Oh, okay.
No. It was the fact that even though Black Kiss itself was printed in Canada, it seemed to have slipped under the radar. Variations was printed in Canada as well. And the sequence in which the teenage hooker pretending to be blind, which is blowing the priest, kept referring to the priest as daddy. And the Canadians took that to mean it was child pornography. They had never heard of sugar daddies or Mac daddies or Daddy Warbucks. I always thought that Daddy Warbucks and Little Orphan Annie had that kind of relationship, but nobody. The love that dare not speak its name.
That is the later years, exactly.
Yeah, I like that title right there, Annie the later years.
Well, that feeds the vibe of Lost Girls, exactly.
I'm with you. Well, you know, you might be onto something here. Mary Worth, Little Orphan Annie, and Little Annie Rooney.
There you go.
Rusty Riley as the ringer, you know. There you go. You gained my eternal love by being able to recognize I was a communist with the FBI. So I'm on your team, pal.
Yeah, before we started the interview, we're swapping old-time radio fan stories, so that's cool. And, you know, I did that with Jeff Darrow, too. He's a big Gunsmoke fan.
Really?
Yes.
I like the Western stuff. My favorite Western was probably Fort Laramie.
That's a good one. Yeah, Raymond Burr.
The idea of listening to Raymond Burr playing a guy skinning up to be on a horse was really enough for me.
William Conrad in Gunsmoke.
William Conrad, exactly.
You need a plow horse for Matt Dillon.
We will now get to the digressive portion of the interview.
That's the
fun. Every time I think of Bill Conrad, everybody thinks of Gunsmoke on radio or Cannon on TV.
You bet.
And for me, he shows up as a character in Alex Toth's Crushed Gardenia. And in the drawing, he looks sort of like the stylized linear caricature that was used on the Alfred Hitchcock Show, if it were a drawing of Paul Whiteman.
Okay.
Of course, anybody in the audience who knows who Paul Whiteman is probably dead.
I know Paul Whiteman. That'd be
I had a feeling you did.
The 30s jazz orchestra leader.
20s, but that's okay.
Okay.
He was the so-called king of jazz.
Yes.
He was a white guy who read a rinky-tink hotel orchestra that happened to feature Dick Spiderbeck and Frankie Trumbauer, who were two great white musicians of the period, who also did the original version of Rhapsody in Blue. Bill Conrad was a character in Crushed Gardenia, drawn by Toth, and it was a great, distillation of the Conrad visual appearance of that period.
That's wild.
Take a look at Crushed Gardenia, you'll see what I mean.
That's really cool. Back to your stuff.
I told you, digression is my life.
But I enjoy that. Congratulations on New Avengers 21. I think
it
looked great.
Thank you. Look, I had a great time with that. It was just an absolute ball doing that stuff. I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm making a shift to Marvel right now.
Yeah, and you got Blade coming up.
As I speak, we're polishing the first half.
Very cool.
Getting it out. We're going to be delivering it on Wednesday.
Now, in those cases, obviously,
we deliver early here, which is kind of weird. we're curious in the context of comic book talent.
You took 10 years off, and where would you say your drawing speed or satisfaction with your work is compared to before your time off?
Okay, I mean, I don't hate myself anywhere nearly as much.
Well, that's very good.
It's a big deal. It's a huge deal for me.
How much are you able to do, a page a day, a page every couple?
We turn out about a book a month, a little over a book a month.
Okay.
With wiggle room for other stuff.
So it's really just releases that makes it look like you've got so much stuff coming out right now.
Yeah, well, we actually deliver on time. One of the reasons that stuff doesn't seem to come out from talent in the comic book business is that, generally speaking, nobody pays any attention to deadlines. And I pay attention to deadlines because I've got a lifestyle to support.
Fair enough.
I've got a life that I prefer to live rather than have it dictated to me by comic books. So that's how it works for me.
When you're designing a page, nowadays, are you using any of the computer, stuff to do your art as opposed to the old days of sitting down with a pen and, the board and everything?
To a profound extent, I look back on Flags, for example,
mm-hmm.
and Black Kiss to a lesser degree, and Times Squared, is we were anticipating the advent of Photoshop, 20 years ago. And we use Photoshop now as in lieu of Zip-A-Tone and repeats and paste-ups, because frankly, Zip-A-Tone is too expensive. I scanned all my Zip, and we now have it on. I have digital files of all my Zip-A-Tone plus newly created patterns. So we use Photoshop for whatever Zip-A-Tone patterns and repetitions we use.
That's really cool. I've never seen anyone use the wall of sound effects like you do.
Mm-hmm.
To help design a page, and it really is a Chaikin trademark that I always look forward to in an action sequence. Where did that inspiration come from?
A lot of it, evolved out of discussions with Ken Brusenak. I mean, Brusenak is, in my opinion, inarguably, the best letterer of comics has ever had, because he combined strong textual lettering with a great sense of display and art direction. Ken and I haven't worked together regularly for a while, but we just recently did a huge project for Disney Italia called Century West, which is basically a revisionist Western, which should be out in the States in an English language edition sometime in 2007.
Cool.
The Italian edition will be out, I believe, the end of the year.
Man, it seems like the Italians are always ahead of us when it comes to other genres. I just, a year ago, finished Joe Kubert's Tex, and it was just fantastic. And it's like, you know, I'm glad to see that it seems like now the American market is being more inclusive with the other genres, and it isn't just a superhero game as much as it was 10 years ago.
Oh, I hope you're right.
Okay, you know, well, you have the perspective, Howard, so, you know, tell me, because it certainly seems...
I mean, look, the fact is, I still think it's a predominantly superhero-based market, and I'm okay with that. It just is what it is. Like I said, I'm going to be doing a prequel to Black Kid. I've got two crime books that I'd like to do. One is a period piece, and one is a contemporary piece. Both extremely violent, with strong sexual content, and oddly enough, not nihilistic. And, you know, and I'm waiting on both of those, simply because it's not a market that I think would actively support this kind of material. You know, I mean, I'll be real curious to see how the Western does in this country, because it's not a spaghetti Western in the sense of, say, Jonah Hex or Loveless or any of those books.
Mm-hmm.
Where at the same time, though, it's not as controversial a book as Kid Colt was with John Severin and those great Dave Johnson covers.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, it's actually a very straightforward telling of a town in West Texas that's experiencing the onslaught of 20th century technology and dealing with it. It's sometimes, without being specific, it takes place sometime between 1903, which is to say the Wright brothers' first flight,
mm-hmm.
and 1914, which is to say the shooting of the Archduke Ferdinand, which set the First World War in place.
Yes.
So it takes place sometime in that period without being any more specific than that. And it's about, you know, a town where streets are being paved, electric lights, automobiles, airplanes, movies, telephones, and vacuum cleaners. And so it's just all about that and the people's reaction to it. And I had a great time with it, which is a very exciting job to do.
That's cool. I've always appreciated your, you know, infusion of real history in a lot of your stories.
Well, this is not really history. It's pretty revisionist. I mean, it's fabulous. You know, I mean, there's racial equality in this book, which is non-existent at the time.
Yeah.
But it was a rare opportunity to impose some presentism on stuff.
Okay.
And have some fun with that. The period crime book that I've got in my hopper is much darker and much harder boiled, if you will.
So what's the title of that?
I'd rather not say.
So that's not even ready to talk about yet?
No.
Okay, fair enough. I've read in interviews where you've said American flag was your response to the Reagan era.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously what was happening in 80s society, and kind of a liberal snowball to attack. And I got to wonder, you must have a million politically bent ideas with what's going on today.
Well, I mean, what got me called a left-wing faggot on the Internet was Challenge of the Unknown.
Really?
Yeah. Obviously, you didn't read the book.
I did read the book. But, you know, okay. Well, I guess I'm used to your stuff, man. So I was like, cool. It's
right.
More.
I mean,
it's Howard Jenkins being Howard Jenkins.
Look, I mean, I don't wear my politics on my sleeve, but I certainly wear it on my lapel. and I'm pretty comfortable with my politics as they are.
Uh huh.
You know, it's just the way it is. I am a left wing faggot. What can I tell you? You know, but not in a gay way.
Right. The wussy definition.
Oh, yeah.
As we continue, I was wondering about television. I know you've wrapped up since Mutant X, and that's what really brought you back to comics.
I got shit canned 4 years ago.
Wow.
And, well, you know, it was actually the best thing that ever happened to me. I had a good long, solid run.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of TV shows that I worked on no longer exist. That market has disappeared. I haven't worked on network shows since 93, and nobody's going to hire me anyway. It would require it would require a year's worth of work to reinvent myself, working for free in terms of creating samples with no guarantee of ever getting anywhere. And I just decided that I didn't really want to take that chance.
Wow.
I didn't feel like doing it anymore. And I sold DC a book in Mighty Love.
Yes.
And I just decided I didn't want to go back to, I didn't want to go back to TV anymore. I was perfectly happy doing this.
Okay. It would seem the cable environment might be more conducive to a lot of your ideas.
I mean, you have to understand that the way television works, it's not what you're selling, it's who's selling it. The best story I can tell you is this is like 6 years ago. I was at CBS, and I pitched the show about a private detective in ancient Rome.
Okay.
And you left right there, right?
Yeah.
It happens that there are half a dozen series by half a dozen different writers in crime fiction who are writing various versions of that idea.
Okay.
Okay. I got the same reaction out of CBS. They laughed at it. 2 weeks later, David Milch sold a series that was basically NYPD Blue in ancient Rome. Okay?
Yes.
That show ended up not happening.
Okay.
But it evolved into Rome on HBO.
There you go.
Okay?
Gotcha.
The fact that I can come in with the best idea in the world, but if I'm not someone they want to work with, it's irrelevant. A couple of years back, Warner Brothers Television decided they wanted to do a Flash TV series again.
Okay.
But they wanted it to be about time travel. And I had absolutely no idea why that was their condition and that was their perk. I told my agent at the time that I didn't want to go into the meeting. They insisted. I went into the meeting with a concept, which ultimately turned out to be very similar to what they did in the movie The Butterfly Effect.
Oh, yeah, The Butterfly Effect, yes.
Yeah. And ultimately, they ended up going with someone who was a non-writing producer. And they loved the idea, but they didn't go with me because they weren't going to go with me in the first place. They're going to go with someone who they're in business with already, was attached to a hot property. In the same way that comics right now is going through a period of wanting to hire a lot of writers for television and movies.
Yes.
Television is always in the business of wanting to hire writer guys who write movies.
Okay.
To varying degrees of success.
Sure, sure.
Okay. Frequently, when feature writers come to work in television, they figure it out how to do it. Many times they don't. Television is a very different medium than, I mean, television's relationship to movies is similar to the relationship that comic books have, or the newspaper strips have to comic books. They use the same tools,
mm-hmm.
but what they're selling is entirely different. And when a feature guy comes in to write television, he has to learn that what he's actually writing is 43 minutes of material that is going to be shot, usually speaking, in 7 days with 2 days of second unit.
Mm-hmm.
If he's lucky. And in the perfect world, he would never leave his standing set. If the minute you step outside, go out into the street, you're spending money you don't have.
Right, right. Yeah, the budget increases, certainly.
Okay. And you've also got a cast that you've got to service. So the show has to be both about the characters that you've got on a weekly basis. Your guest cast is there solely to support them. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Even on a client show. You know, like a private detective show would generally speaking be a client show.
Okay.
But you look at a show. I mean, my favorite private detective show over the past couple of years was a series that nobody else watched called Eyes.
Yeah, I saw you saying that you've been watching. That was the Tim Daly ABC show, correct?
Yeah, Johnny McNamara.
Okay. Yeah, great director. Absolutely.
I mean, John McNamara is one of my favorite people. He's a terrific TV writer, and I always hesitate to tell him when he's doing something I love because it means it's certain death. I love Vengeance Unlimited.
Okay.
A show with Michael Madsen.
Yeah, Michael Madsen. That's another ABC show that came in.
A great show. I love Profit.
I did too. I just bought the DVD.
I wrote episode 9 of Profit.
Oh, that's excellent. I just bought the DVDs.
They stopped shooting at 8. There are references to characters from my episode in I think 4 and 5. And, you know, so I love Johnny stuff. And Eyes was a perfect example of a client show where the clients are totally irrelevant, totally unmemorable, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
It's all about those great characters.
Sure.
It's about Tim Daly and all of his crew,
mm-hmm.
the interpersonal relationships, and yet, on a weekly basis, the clients bring in the problem, but it's the regular cast solution to those problems. That's what counts.
Sure.
That's the job. And it sounds easier than it is, I guess, because I had a very hard time getting comic book guys to come in and learn how to service the cast, and feature guys tend to write too big.
Wow.
So, you know, but that's what's going on. Because the dirty secret of television, of course, is if you've got something going, television's where the money is.
Certainly.
You know, that's where the money really is. And I'm still completely, I'm a total TV junkie. I'm a TiVo addict. You know, I'm serious. I mean,
What shows do you like right now?
What, you mean this summer right now or general?
Well, just in general. Yeah, in general.
I'm a huge fan of The Shield, Rescue Me.
You bet.
I really liked Andre Brower's show Thief, which nobody
yes.
else watched. I liked Heist from the Coen brothers. I thought they did a really nice job. I was a big fan of Lucky. Lucky made John Corbett an interesting actor for me.
That was the ESPN show, right?
No.
Lucky was FX.
That's the thing with Michael Madsen, which I actually I have not yet, I got to call my ESPN guy and tell him he needs to send me that on DVD. The reason is because Larry Block was involved in that show, and I'm a huge fan of Lawrence Block.
Okay.
No, Lucky was about a gambler in Vegas with John Corbett.
Yes, the other FX show, yes.
And Dave Gardell.
Okay.
Both have showed up on Heist. I love Deadwood.
That's cool.
I did not like the first season of Entourage, but I love the second, and the third is great. I love Entourage.
Yeah, me too.
My wife feels about Entourage. I like Big Love a great deal as well. I watch that show regularly.
I couldn't get into it.
She said, you just like watching a show about a guy who gets to fuck three women. I said, no, it's more complex than that. It's Harry Dean Stanton. And she says, Entourage is just a boy show. And I said, no, it's not. I'm not a guy, I don't give a shit about boy shit. I really like Rescue Me a great deal.
Me too.
I'm looking forward to The Shield. Nip Tuck gets one more chance. His last season was a real shark jumper for me.
Okay.
I liked the show for a long time, and I just had no idea. This past season was just completely insane. The shows that died this past season that I liked Conviction.
Okay.
I also liked Injustice, the show on ABC with Kyle MacLachlan and the other guy.
Wow, I totally forgot about that show.
Yeah, it just slipped away. I like this. There's a BBC series on AMC called Hustle.
I love Hustle.
I really like
it. Do you watch MI5?
No, I've never seen it.
Because it's the same producers. It's Kudos. They make that show, too.
Where is it on? Is it on BBC America?
It was on A&E.
Oh, you know, I missed that. You know, it predated my ownership of TiVo.
But you know something? Buy it on DVD because they take out 15 minutes to fit into American television.
Oh, okay.
And
it's worth seeing?
I think it's excellent.
Okay.
So, yeah, and I would say if you like Hustle, it's definitely got that vibe. A little less tongue-in-cheek, a little more serious, but
how the fuck old is Robert Vaughn, man?
No kidding.
I mean, you figure, he goes back to I Was a Teenage Caveman. That's 1929. Right, okay?
Yes.
I'm serious.
You're absolutely...
I Was a Teenage Caveman was 1959.
Yes.
All right? So how old was he when he did that?
Well, you figure early 20s.
Okay, so you figure he was born in 38, 37?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, there you go.
So is he 80 years old? I'm serious. Right?
No, you're right. I met him. He was in Chicago like a few years ago on a autograph thing, and we had him on the radio, and he was great.
He's a great story. I'm a huge man from Uncle Sam.
Me too.
Absolutely. I mean, I never understood the David Kuryakin appeal. I mean, for me, it was always Napoleon Solo. You know? I'm serious. I mean, how old are you? You're 42.
I'm 41, yeah.
I watched the Uncle stuff from Word One. I mean, I was watching it brand new on TV.
You bet.
And I have no memory of any of those shows whatsoever because it's a blur. But I was a complete Man from Uncle fanatic. And I loved Vaughn. We tried to get Vaughn on Viper. We did an episode of Viper where we tried to cast a secret agent actor from the 60s to play a 60s secret agent.
That's cool.
And we ended up with Bob Culp.
Oh, that's cool.
We did a great job for it.
Absolutely.
But we went after Robert Vaughn, we went after David McCallum, you know, we went through the whole list. and Culp came through and did great work for us. So I love Hustle. Let me see, what else? I'm the best show on television, in my opinion, is The Wire.
I love The Wire.
The Wire is the best show on TV.
That's Azzarello's favorite show, too, by the way.
Has ever done.
Very cool.
In my opinion. It's got three of my favorite writers working on staff. You know, or at least on doing freelance. That's George Pelicanos, Dennis Lehane, and Richard Price.
Yeah. Nice Murderer's Row.
All they got to do is bring Thomas Perry, Dennis Lehane, and Stephen Hunter, Thomas Perry, and Lee Child on board, and I can die happy. But that is, I mean, and again, The Wire is someone you can recommend Deadwood, you can recommend Entourage. It's hard to recommend The Wire because it is so complicated. And so difficult, and it doesn't in no way, in any way, bothers to give a shit about pleasing the audience. I'm serious. I mean,
yes.
My wife became very frustrated with it about halfway through season three and stopped watching it because she found that she could not understand what was being said and she couldn't follow the action. And it is, I mean, you cannot watch it broadcast. You have to watch it on tape.
Absolutely.
Because you have to rewind a dialogue in a number three or four times to get exactly what you get the nuance of the scene. I love it.
That's cool. My buddy Jim True Forrest is on that show.
Ah, one of my favorite guys.
He's
love that guy's work. I mean, I first became aware of him on an episode of Criminal Intent where he played a really good killer. assuming he's a New York actor, right?
He's a Chicago guy.
Oh, he's a Chicago guy?
Yeah, Steppenwolf, absolutely.
No shit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I went to high school with him. He's a great guy.
But the transformation that his character goes through on that first season is fantastic.
Yep.
Where he goes from being the complete fuck up to figure, to being the guy because he's doing those obnoxious word puzzles. My mother was addicted to those. just the relationship between him and Freeman is just fantastic.
Yeah, he's excellent, and I'm always really happy that he's in, you know, something of that quality.
Is he back in season four?
That's a good question. I haven't talked to him, so I don't know.
Yeah, the whole number with season three went on there.
You know, and I didn't see all of season three. I'm still waiting. Did the DVD come out?
No, it comes out next month.
Okay, because I kind of lost track, and I'm like, well, I don't miss it.
So you haven't seen season three?
I haven't seen all of season three, no.
Have you seen the end of season three?
No. Well, I figured I'd see it on DVD before it comes out.
Big business.
I'm looking forward to it, man. That's very funny.
Season three ends in such a way that if it weren't in season four, it would be okay.
Okay.
All right? There is closure in the end of season three.
Well, yeah, I kind of
really
heard
interesting
that.
Closure.
Okay.
Okay? I mean, one of my best friends had never seen the series, and I lent him my copy of the DVD, and as he says, it's the middle of fucking June. It's a beautiful day in Ventura. I'm living near the beach, and there I am, locked in my house for 13 straight fucking hours watching TV. Watched it in one sitting.
Wow.
Okay? Totally insane.
That's hardcore.
I liked Rome a great deal on HBO as well. I know a lot of people didn't. I thought it was really good.
I liked Rome, too.
I thought that the relationship between the two centurions was fantastic.
Well, then
I'm really curious to see what's going to happen in the second season.
That Irish guy, and I forget his name, the character actor that plays Caesar,
Kieran Hines?
Yes.
He's fantastic. I mean, I first became aware of him in that Ben Affleck, Jack Ryan movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Being the new young premier of the Soviet Union.
Yes.
And he was so clearly Irish, even in that. You know? I mean, he's great in Calendar Girls.
And, Road to Perdition.
Right.
I mean, it's just the first 15 minutes, but he's fantastic.
Yeah, he's got that great hatchet face. I mean, me and Jeffrey Rush, for me, are the best things in Munich.
You know? Yes. Absolutely.
We do digress.
Good. I'm glad you liked Munich.
I'm not a huge fan of Munich.
No?
No, I was not. I was not crazy about the movie.
Okay.
But I thought they were the only good things in the movie.
Oh, I enjoyed the movie. Yeah, I mean, not enjoyed it because that's really sick, but, you know, I thought it was
still
a great
good movie of the new millennium. There you go.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's get back to your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I would love to see you do, if I may be a fan for a second and request
an enormous amount of money sitting on my fat ass eating macaroni and cheese. I knew you'd see it my way.
No.
No, that isn't what you were going to say.
No.
Damn.
I wanted to see you get back to Black Hawk, and especially with today's world attitude towards the United States government.
I mean, I love the Blackhawks, and I happen to think that after I left the book, Marty Pasco and Rick Bruchette did such great shit with it.
Okay.
That if I were going to come back on the Blackhawks, I would be spinning off from that.
Okay.
I would love, I mean, rather than do a 40s book, I'd love to do a 50s book. Because I always believed that, here's a digression for you, that Steve Canyon, in the first couple of years of the strip before he went back to the Army?
Yes.
Air Force, rather?
Yes.
That Horizons Unlimited was Air America. That it was a CIA-fronted cargo operation.
Yes.
And I would love to do the Blackhawks as the paramilitary wing of the CIA.
You see, that would be cool. Yeah.
Shutting down governments that were hostile to us, regardless of their own personal feelings. You know? Do something along those lines.
Well, then that's...
In that regard... The third strip that I've got playing around with is a mid-1930s aviation strip.
Okay.
About a forgotten war in South America. A real historical element.
Cool.
I wanted to do something about this. I love the work of a guy named Alan First, who's one of these, a cult figure in the historical novelist. You know his work at all?
No, I don't, no.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
I am.
I'm not kidding. Write this down.
All right,
his name is A-L-A-N. F as in Frank, U-R-S-T.
Okay.
His new novel, The Foreign Correspondent, is very good. If I were to start with anything, I'd start with his third novel, which is called The Polish Officer.
Okay.
All right. There's a vintage trade paperback collection that's the Uniform Editions. You'll thank me.
Wait, you know, I think maybe in researching your interview, I seem to remember something about The Polish Officer.
He's not a writer of thrillers, per se. They are melancholic historical pieces about the Second World War.
Okay.
You'll dig them.
Was Polish Officer, was that about being in the RAF?
No. Okay. That's Derek Robinson stuff.
Okay.
The Polish Officer is about a Polish map maker.
Okay.
Who becomes the head of the Polish Secret Service in exile at a patrician.
That sounds cool.
Done.
All right.
And his various skills lead him to adventures in occupied Europe. They're all great. He's just a wonderful, just wonderful stuff.
All right, Alan.
I mean, I read everything this guy writes, including the novels he doesn't ever mention. He wrote a whole bunch of novels in the late 70s and the early 80s, which he disavows.
Wow. Now, you know, it's funny. Your description of what you want to do with Black Hawk is kind of what I saw in American Century.
Yes, to a certain extent.
Because, yeah, it was like Pat Ryan after the war, it almost seemed like.
Exactly.
You know?
But I always thought, you see, for me, the most interesting thing about Milton Caniff was how Caniff made the shift from 1930s, you know, left liberal, anti-communist.
Yes.
To
Republican.
1950s, right-wing, anti-communist.
Yes.
And I always felt it was the same thing that happened to him was what happened to Ronald Reagan, you know, which is that Reagan was, they always said that Reagan was subsumed by General Electric.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I always felt that Caniff himself was subsumed by the United States Air Force.
Wow. Because, you know, it's funny. I just listened to Peter Bogdanovich interviewing Orson Welles.
Uh-huh.
And Welles says the same thing. He's like, I love Terry and the Pirates. Steve Canyon, he's like, he completely lost me. I don't know what happened to Caniff.
And he, are you talking about comics?
Yeah. Oh, he was a huge comics fan.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where did
absolutely.
You get this interview?
This was the audio version of that book, This is Orson Welles, that Bogdanovich did.
Really?
And it was, yeah. Oh, you definitely need to get that. It's literally just their conversations.
You recommend the audio over the video?
Yeah, I do.
Over the text?
Yeah, because you're really hearing Welles, you know, in his voice. I mean, you can appreciate the inflections of when he's being wry and when he's being serious.
Okay. I mean, the thing is, I don't commute anymore, you know?
Okay.
And this is serious. I mean, I lease a car. I used to drive. I used to live in two places. I now live in one.
Okay.
And I do so little driving, you know, because I work at home.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's different.
I get up in the morning. I go to a get together with cronies. My driving these days is I go to breakfast with friends, and I go to the gym.
Okay.
And that's about it. and occasionally the movies, you know. But I do so little driving that I just, you know, I'm nowhere near my annual quota of mileage here. So. So basically, I don't like to listen to books on tape at home.
Okay.
That's for driving. I mean, I've got
sure.
You know, but I'd be real curious to read. I had no idea.
No, it's really good. Yeah, it's really good.
The problem with Steve Canyon for me was that the first couple of weeks, a month rather, pretty good, and then he immediately started repeating himself. He started recycling Terry stories.
Okay.
And the artwork just got very sloppy.
Oh, that's interesting. Because yeah, you know, it's funny. I just bought. I'm looking on my bookshelf the 1951 Checker. Steve Canyon reprint stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I mean, I mean, obviously, even lukewarm Caniff is still great and wonderful to read and wonderful to see, I think. It seems like DC is testing the waters with Claw and Warlord, and I was wondering if Iron Wolf might come back.
Not in my world. Well, they can, sure, but I'm not going to be doing it. I can't imagine. I mean, the thing is that I believe that the Claw and the Warlord stuff is just a lot easier to sell than Iron Wolf. Iron Wolf is a little obscure.
Okay.
You know?
Are there pet projects that you'd want to bring back of anything that you've done in the past? I mean, I know that they're repackaging.
Not really.
Okay. Are you still doing new American Flag stuff for the Dynamic Forces thing?
I did a new 12-page story.
Okay.
And, you know, whenever the hell that thing comes out.
Is there any information on what the delay is?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I mean, I confuse easily.
Another thing I wanted to ask while you were talking about not being able to hear audiobooks because you're not commuting, what do you listen to when you draw?
Let's see. What's on my turntable today? My turntable, can you believe it?
There you go.
Actually, it's all CDs. it's a three-disc tray because I used to have a five in a jukebox and it got to be too complicated. And disc number one, it's Dexter Gordon stuff from the late 1940s, early 1950s.
Cool.
Disc number two is, two and three is Helen Hume stuff. The Helen Hume stuff is from the late 20s to the mid 30s, and then the late stuff is on the third disc. What I've been listening to this past week has been some Benny Carter stuff, good Benny Carter stuff.
Cool.
Some early doo-wop, some Sidney Bechet, some Western Swing, mostly Adolph Brown and his musical Brownies, and some Milton Hofner stuff. Looking across the room there. Oh, and Elmore James, or some good Elmore James.
That's cool.
Strange Blues.
Do you
and Charlie Christian?
Do you ever, you know, like when you're writing a period piece, do you make sure that you've got the music of the period while you're drawing?
No. One has nothing to do with the other.
Okay.
I mean, I have about 5,000 CDs.
Yeah, I know you're a big music freak. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I own a lot of. I mean, most of it's jazz.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a lot of strange country western. and just an obscurest music. You know, I mean, the only thing I don't listen to is, I don't listen to contemporary pop.
Okay.
I don't listen to world music because it bores the shit out of me.
What can you tell us about the JLA Classified story you've got coming up?
Yeah, I just got the first two issues lettered, and man, are they bitching.
Cool.
Kelly and Plunkett just kicks ass. I mean, I had such a good time with that stuff. I did that stuff a couple of years back, and we waited for Killian to be finished with it. Now that he's done, it's basically, the directive was, do an espionage story in which our heroes are forced by circumstance, by political or more. I mean, this is what they said. We'd like to do a story where our guys can't wear their costumes.
There you go. Okay.
And I came back, and that's ultimately what it evolved into.
Wow.
And it's basically about the UN directing them that they cannot be involved in something that they have to be involved with. So ultimately, our guys go undercover. And if I do say so myself, I came up with a really pretty funny way for them to get away with it.
That's cool.
And Killian just did an absolute ass kick of a job. Like I said, I've seen issues 1 and 2. All 6 are drawn and inked. And I'm sort of waiting for the lettered versions to come my way. They look bitchin'.
That's excellent.
And it comes out next month, right? Starts next month?
I think in 2 months. I want to say September.
No, I think it might be August.
Okay. I thought I saw it in the...
I could be wrong.
Well, it might have been issue 2.
I've been wrong, too. I was running the... For some reason, I was on the assumption that the new Avengers is coming out on the 12th of this month.
And it's out.
I completely got fella boosted in terms of when what was happening when.
Any thoughts on Bendis? Did you have a
chance? We had a ball.
I mean,
it was very challenging. The way Brian thinks about storytelling is very different from mine.
Okay.
And what I wanted to do was to respect what he did, but not be subsumed at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a couple of days to figure out, sort of like decode what he was looking for and what I had to do with it. And I think I'm pretty happy with the result. They seem to be pretty happy too.
It's fantastic.
You know, I mean, look, Captain America is one of my favorite characters at Marvel. I love the character because I am a popular fronter. You know, I'm like, I come out of a day when patriotism and liberalism were in the same place, and I still believe they are.
Yep.
So fuck these right-wing cops. But I say this with love, of course. And I had just a great time doing it. And doing Cap out front without the outfit and then coming into the outfit, I thought the Hank Pym sequences were a hoot.
Yes.
But that was a lot of fun to play with. We just had a great time. It was just a real ball. And again, the Blade stuff is in the same place. I mean, I'm looking over pages right now. We're literally in the process of whiting out the borders on pages 9, 10, and 11 of the first half of the book. And, you know, there's a flashback sequence that we've got here, and there's some... I'm having a great time.
That's really cool. No, I'm looking forward to it, and yeah, I mean...
You've seen the first drawing that appeared on the website.
Yes. I mean, as soon as I heard Jenkins doing Blade, it's like, okay, fine. Everyone's in. And Guggenheim...
The only difference is he's not black-haired, black-eyed, and Jewish. You know, that's the only... I can't do that. It's not my guy.
That's true. Tell me about Guggenheim and writing as a writer.
I like what Mark's doing. I mean, Mark and I seem to be pretty simpatico. He's given me plenty of room to expand on images. It's funny stuff, and I'm hoping he's as happy with what he gets from me. You know, we've been trading emails. You know, and I'm taking off on some of the things he's suggesting and running with it. And you know, look, I like doing urban stuff. You know,
yes,
street stuff, and you know, all that. The stuff that takes place in real world. And that's what I'm doing here. I mean, for example, I'm looking at a flashback sequence to when Blade was 12, you know, to where he was raised, and it's London with you know all this. I'm having a great time.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And if I may very quickly, Walter Simonson and Hawkgirl.
Mm-hmm.
I've enjoyed the run so far. Is it just a limited run that you're going to be with Walter?
My last issue is 56.
Okay.
But I'll be staying on covers for the foreseeable.
Oh, that's cool.
And one of the things I'll be doing today, so that you can be waiting on Michael's desk when he gets in on Wednesday, because DC's closed today. Marvel's open today, but DC's closed.
Okay, interesting.
I'm going to be sending in comps for the cover of 57 and 58. He's got 58 and 59 rather. He's got 57 already. And so that's that.
I wanted to ask you about Thrill Killer.
Yes.
How did you get contacted for the Thrill Killer project?
I've known Dan for years, and Brer and I have, we like the same kind of stories. We read a lot of the same writers.
And I actually don't recall exactly what the genesis of the material was, but it sort of growed like Topsy. And we had a really good time doing it. I mean, I thought it was a lot, you know, it was just one of those jobs that was, it was not tough to do from top to bottom. Everything sort of came together in a very, you know, simple, direct way. You know, I think the last one was the last thing that Archie worked on with me before he died.
Yeah.
And, you know, for some reason, one of the issues, there was a deadline glitch. And I don't remember which one it was. I'm not going to tell you because I don't recall.
Okay.
That for some reason, and I don't recall exactly what happened, what would normally have taken me, you know, a week's worth of delivery time, I had to deliver over a weekend. And it actually turned out, you know, I sort of went on zone hold, and it turned out to be one of the best scripts I've ever written. I was pretty happy. So it all worked out pretty nicely.
Dan even made the suggestion that the characters of Dick Grayson and Barbara Gordon in that story were kind of modeled after Elvis and Rusty in Viva Las Vegas.
I totally agree. Absolutely. I mean, it makes perfect sense. You know, one of the great disappointments is that we never got to do a third one, and we were conceptually coming along with it, and it just never happened. The Elseworld stuff sort of went away.
Yeah, that was an exceptionally popular one. I know they've even made action figures.
Yeah, I've got them actually. The aforementioned grandchildren have been running around with my copies of them all, you know, for the past couple of weeks. No, I'm Batman. No, I'm Batman. I'm the old one.
And
I have to behave immaturely.
And the thing that I love about the thing in particular, too, is that Dan's art gives the story that paperback cover feel throughout the entire story.
Well, I think Dan is one of the most underrated guys working in the comic business in that aspect of the ability, in terms of the painting guys. I think Dan is not taken anywhere nearly as seriously as he should be. I'm a huge fan of his work, and he knows it. You know, on a personal level, I could smack it. No, I wasn't. No, but he's really a terrific painter. I really believe that.
And he credits you for helping him along with his writing of things like the Nocturnals.
I have a hard time seeing that, but if you say so.
He called you his...
You know, I mean, I have no warmth whatsoever for the spooky, spacey stuff. I'm not that kind of ookie-gookie guy.
Well, maybe just writing in general, then.
I'm a pretty practical, real... Not so much a realistic guy, but you know, I'm an observed reality guy, as opposed to a fantasy and science fiction guy. Although I do a little bit of both.
Of course.
You know, but I'm flattered by that attitude.
The only other thing I was going to ask was about a couple sci-fi things. Your work in Star Wars was so brief, 12 issues, but obviously after the fact has become fairly historic. And I wonder, you know, at the time, was it just another, you know, licensed gig?
Yes. I mean, I've told this story any number of times, and it's quite true. I came back from Southern California. I was living in New York at the time. I came back from Southern California with... 400 stills from the movie, and the Macquarie paintings to work with use as reference. And the stills were inert and dead. They really did not look like anything special. They looked like you know, sort of Rocky Jones Space Ranger. And what freaked me out when I saw the picture, because I saw the film some months after I'd finished at least one or, you know, most of the issues of the book, was that the movie did not look like the stills. The movie looked like the Macquarie paintings, which was, I mean, who knew?
Yeah.
You know, I wish I'd done a better job.
Really?
I also wish that Marvel had a real royalty system in at the time that I actually would have made some money off those books.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, I ended up getting $15 a page on top of my rate.
Wow.
For selling millions of copies. Now, I'm not taking credit for selling those millions of copies. The book itself sold those millions of copies. But it would have been nice to take some of that change home.
Sure.
You know, am I bitter about it? Only in retrospect. You know, I might have gotten, I don't know what I would have gotten, but frankly, since this is my job, my vocation, and my avocation, it would have been nice to see someone go. But hey, life is a tabaret, you know.
Thank you, Joel Grey.
I am Joel Grey, and I met Jennifer Grey years ago, before and after the nose job. And what freaked me out was when I met her after the nose job, I didn't recognize her.
That's pretty much everybody.
Well, it's very strange. Lovely girl in both contexts.
Very cool. Will we ever see a return of Cody Starbuck?
Nah, but I always say nah.
Okay.
I have no idea. You know, who knows?
How about,
I mean, the demand has not been screaming with it.
Okay.
My plate is pretty full. I mean, as I speak, I'm putting the finishing touches to the third quarter of the second volume of the Guy Gardner mini I'm doing.
Very cool.
Speaking of SF, and I literally, as I'm speaking, just just polished away the inks on, you know, on one stage, and these pages will be going in on Wednesday. And I've got Blade to work on.
Yes.
So I'm pretty swamped. My plate is full.
I respect
my career
that.
Collapses on a commercial basis. The stuff that I want to do is actually more crime based. You know, I've got a couple of crime comics that I'd love to do. One a contemporary piece, one a period piece that would supersede any SF material. Because if I'm going to publish myself, it's probably going to be, again, more crime based material than SF. I don't think there's that huge a market in the comic book business for SF anyway. Except as it sort of, you know, overlaps into the superhero material.
Okay. If you do go through with those two crime projects, I hope you'll come back and talk about them.
Well, you'll know about the crime stuff happening if my career collapses. No, I'm serious. I mean, that'll be the extent of it. I'll be doing those if I'm forced by circumstances to self-publish. Then that's just one more transition in the life of a cartoonist. I mean, I'm having a pretty damn good time doing what I'm doing now. I'm one happy, lucky son of a bitch. And I mean that with all my heart. Anybody who's whining and bitching and moaning about working in comics, try having a real job.
Now, I'm in radio. I know what it is not to have a real job.
I mean,
believe
I'm blessed. You know, I got it going on in that sense. You know, I mean, I'm sitting here, as I've said more than once, in my executive wardrobe with gym clothes. You know, running my own life and having a pretty good time with it. So, you know, no more whining.
I respect that.
I mean, I've also got the Guy Gardner thing.
Yes, talk about that.
The Guy Gardner book, the first half is completely finished, the second half is half done, and I've got pages 26 through 38, which is in rough pencil form, which is what I'll be doing this week. This week is tight pencils on that stuff and tight pencils on and rough pencils on the second half of Blade. So that's my week's worth of work.
Are you writing the Gardner book as well?
Yes.
That's cool, and I know you're a huge Green Lantern fan.
Yes. That was, you know, when I was a kid, it was, you know, Gil Kane was my homeboy.
You know,
and Guy Gardner is just, it's a fun character to write and draw. And I've taken some liberties. You know, I'm doing my version of Nort.
Okay.
Which is somewhat different from what's been seen. And it's called Collateral Damage, and it's sort of what happens when it's based on the old African proverb is that when elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. It's about what the ancillary results of this huge war between these two empires, between Rand and Thanagar, and how it impacts on the smaller, less important planets.
Okay.
And having a good time.
That's really
cool.
So
I think you'll dig what I did with Warriors. Guy is not quite so goofy and stupid.
Okay.
And neither is Nor.
So he has a kind of a new purpose, Guy.
Yeah.
He isn't just a knucklehead that just kind of reacts and
everything. I think you'll dig it.
That's cool.
And there's some cheap laughs in it, too, which is always a good thing.
Can I ask you very quickly about Guy Gardner? There's been a lot of different characterizations about him since his creation. You know, is this a new take on Guy, or is this a...
I don't know if it's a new take. I always feel that Guy is not as stupid as people play him. And I always feel that he's a blue-collar guy in a white-collar world, and he's a dirty job guy. And I realized halfway through this book, and again, there's no physical resemblance, but I realized that if I were writing a Guy Gardner movie, the guy I'd be writing it at would be Dennis Leary.
Okay.
That Dennis Leary personifies what Guy Gardner is all about.
That's interesting, because, yeah, I'd always take him more for like a Bruce Willis kind of grunt kind of guy and everything. And, yeah, I'm a big fan of Rescue Me, so that's really
an
interesting
me
character.
Too. I mean, Rescue Me is absolutely... I mean, it was weird. The first episode of this new season kind of caught me off guard because I thought they'd sort of backtracked on everything they had set up last season.
Okay.
And by the second episode, everything was back in line. It's just, I love the show.
Yeah, me too.
You know, it's one of my appointment shows.
It's dark and funny.
Yeah. Well, it's also, it uses New York locations beautifully. It's got a great cast. And I love Jack McGee.
Which one's Jack McGee?
Jack's one of my heroes.
Which one is Jack McGee?
Jack McGee is Jerry.
The captain, rather.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, he's a hell of a character actor. Absolutely.
Yeah, Jack is. I know Jack from a couple of years back, and he's. I hope they are lucky to have that guy. He's just doing some astonishing work. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, his arc is really interesting.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
That was harsh with his wife. Absolutely.
It's heartbreaking. He's able to play comedy. He's just a phenomenal. And also, John Skurdy is fantastic. A guy I don't know, like never been aware of before, who's doing some amazing shit.
Is that the guy with Susan Sarandon?
No, that's, I forget his name. He's a Broadway actor I know whose work I know pretty well. Actually, he's in The Devil Wears Prada.
Okay.
You know, playing a dress designer. So John Skurdy is the guy who got taken down by the prostitute last season, and now he's trying to climb out of the hole he created.
No, he's great too, absolutely.
The Lieutenant.
Well, that's a great thing about that show. I wasn't a big fan of The Job, but this ensemble is, I think, even better.
I like The Job, but this is vastly better than The Job.
Yeah.
I also like Jimmy McCaffrey. I mean, you know, I work with Jimmy on Viper.
That's
and,
cool.
And the guy who plays his ghostly cousin.
Okay.
And he's wonderful. I mean, he did a nice turn on The Job as well in a single spot, in a guest spot. And he's doing some great shit on the show. Callie Thorne is fantastic. She's wonderful. I mean, I love her on The Wire and on Homicide.
You bet.
Just fantastic. It's just a great. I mean, one of the things about current television is that the shows that work best seem to be those that really have a strong casting element. I mean, Grey's Anatomy is a perfect example. Grey's Anatomy is a show that has some of the best casting I've ever seen in my life. There is such chemistry among those actors; it's astonishing. You know, I know it may be perceived as a chick show, but I keep coming back.
That's cool.
You know, I love the show, and I watch a lot of television. I'm ashamed to admit. but Grey's Anatomy is one of those shows that I stay with all the time. So.
Do you think? What do you think of the synergy that some people see between? And I know we talked about it earlier in our conversation, but between comics and television arcs, and the way that you know they're doing the continuing story. It's almost like a Marvel style.
Well, I think that there's, I mean, the fact that I applied a lot of what I knew from writing and drawing comics to working in television when I did.
Sure.
And I think that, you know, there are an awful lot of guys working in television right now who clearly, for whom their first reading and writing experience was comics. And it shows. You know, so it's, so basically you've got, you know, just lots of different stuff, you know, and I don't see it in any more specific than that. I think it's of a piece. I mean, you know, I always point out the fact that, you know, two of my secret influences beyond, you know, movies, comics, everything else are Richard Condon.
Princey's Honor, yeah.
Well, you say Princey's Honor, but also The Manchurian Candidate.
Yeah, I was about to say, and of course The Manchurian Candidate.
And Winter Kills, you know. I mean, a guy who in his time was perceived as a somewhat broad-stroke political satirist who, in retrospect, looked like he was, you know, he's a hard realist. And Bob Fosse.
That's interesting.
Who really, you know, brought a kind of a level of erotic dance to mainstream media. And, I mean, Fosse's a guy who was, you know, avowedly heterosexual who was involved in what was perceived as a predominantly gay business.
Yes, choreography.
And just, you know, just an amazing character, one of my real cultural heroes.
That's cool. When you say that, that makes sense, looking back at a lot of your stuff.
I love the guy's work. You know, I mean, it was Gil Kane who got me interested in dance in the first place, and Fosse is always one of my heroes and gods.
A writer friend of mine had told me that he had heard that you and Gil were talking about doing a sequel to His Name Is Savage before.
No, actually, one of the last projects we discussed. I mean, he was supposed to draw Legend, the thing that Russ Heath ended up drawing.
Uh huh.
But when he read the script, he freaked out because it was too much work. Gil had his issues. We talked at some length about doing a pastiche of Tom Mix's life.
Tom Mix's life, okay.
Yeah, both of us are huge Tom Mix fans, in the sense that of the influence that Tom Mix had on popular culture in general and the Western in particular. You know, the irony of the fact that William S. Hart was a Shakespearean actor out of New York who came to personify the real West, whereas Tom Mix, who was an actual Westerner, was the guy who introduced the elements of the circus and the carnival into the Western. And you know, you couldn't have Roy Rogers and Dale Evans without Tom Mix. And Mix's life was just fascinating, just a source of enormous contradiction. And, you know, the first time I met Gil was in a bookstore in Brooklyn, where he was looking for Will James' books. And Will James was a lifelong friend of Tom Mix's. And, you know, both men sort of model for each other in the sense of the sort of the line of crap there was. I mean, Will James was a guy who was a child. I mean, he was Quebecois out of Montreal, who ran away from home and reinvented himself as a cowboy. So
that was actually one of the projects we wanted to pursue.
That's
never really
cool.
happened. You know.
Wow. Well, Howard, I appreciate your time. And
again, thanks for your attention. I do appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and looking forward to the new projects, and always happy to reread the old ones as well. So,
what a guy.
Hey, man, you know, like I said, I'm a fan going way back, so keep it up, and hopefully down the line we could talk again about some of the other stuff when it's ready to be talked about.
I'm a man who likes talking to a man who likes to talk.
Thank you, Casper Gutman.
And you know your references, too. Good shit.
One of the masters of comic art, Howard Chaykin. He'll be lurking about at the San Diego Comic-Con, and so will I for Word Balloon. I'll be there all weekend long at the Century Guild booth number 2945 with the new Word Balloon promotional magazine featuring transcriptions of past interviews with guys like Brian Michael Bendis, Jeff Darrow, Greg Rucka, Jeff Johns, you name it. Plus, Sunday, there's a podcast seminar at 11:30 a.m. in Room 8, where I'll share the stage with comic podcasters from shows like iFanboy, Comic Geek Speak, The Indie Spinner Rack, Fanboy Radio, and more, with our moderator, writer B. Clay Moore. Hope to see you there. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks so much for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to the Word Balloon website for updates on upcoming episodes, including some creator interviews conducted at the convention floor at San Diego and Wizard World Chicago. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2006.